I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Deborah Tabart, OAM, CEO of the Australian Koala Foundation. Fondly known as the Koala Woman, she's been at her post since February 1988. At that time, she was told to raise $5 million and, quote, save the koala, end quote. Since that time, Deborah has focused her attention on mapping koala habitat. If you can't save habitat, you'll never save any species. The AKF takes no government funding and has, over the years, spoken more and more confidently about the plight of the koala. The AKF scientifically estimates there are between 50,000 and 100,000 koalas in the wild remaining. Deborah believes the lower number is the accurate figure. Between 1890 and 1927, the AKF has found manifests for 8 million koala skins, which were sold on the New York and London fur market. So first, I would like to thank you for your work, and second, I'd like to thank you for being on the program.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
So let's just start with an introduction to koalas. Who are they? And I mean, people have probably seen pictures, but who are they? What do they eat? What do they like? What's to love about them?
The Australian Koala Foundation is often in trouble because we, you know, people say, look, you're only interested in a beautiful, charismatic animal. But let me tell you, the koala is such an amazing species. And when I started all those years ago, like all Australians, I loved them because they're so cute. But they are so important in the ecological niche. They don't eat any crops. They don't hurt anyone. They just sit in the trees looking beautiful. They live in a gum tree, a eucalyptus species. We now know what they eat. They smell like a eucalyptus gumdrop. If you cuddle one in a zoo, they are quite compliant and, you know, you can cuddle them, and often there are some animals that actually love it. But if you're like me and you're in the bush, koalas are quite dangerous. You know, some of the big males have huge claws. And like all species, they have their colonies, they have their behaviours. And during the course of this interview, I'm sure I'll talk more about some of the koalas that I know, and I have actually written a book about the personalities of the koalas. You can have grumpy ones, you can have happy ones, you can have really mean ones, and the males are different to the females, and of course the joeys are just irresistible.
So, well, first, I live with bears. I see bears every single day where I live, and it's exactly the same, that there are some bears who are very mellow and some who are... Oh, we just got introduced to a new bear a couple days ago who is quite terrified and fairly aggressive, but that's probably because he's been trapped elsewhere, brought in, and he's scared. So anyway, yes, they all have personalities.
Yes, well, as you say that, of course I have to say that koalas are marsupials, and interestingly enough, Darwin, when he came to Australia all those years ago, was of the opinion that Australian animals hadn't been finished, in inverted commas. There's a wonderful book called Koala by Dr. Anne Moyle, which describes this, and the British thought that all the animals on the Australian continent were ugly, including the koalas, and they wanted to paint them like sloths. But of course they're a marsupial, they carry their babies in a pouch, and, you know, for some of your listeners who are interested in our natural history, there is so much to read about how unique all the species in Australia are. And so, of course, they're not bears, they're koalas, they're marsupials. And we radio-tracked some koalas when I first got my job, and there was an old koala called... we ended up calling her the bleating female because she absolutely hated the thought of being captured. And so we didn't even have to put a collar on her because we could hear her. Every time she saw the researchers coming with a ladder, she would start crying and there'd be this, oh, bleating sort of sound. So, yes, we have all manner of personalities in koalas, and I think that is so important for people who want to help saving them. And scientists, as you know, sometimes don't like anthropomorphizing koalas, but in fact on that development site that we radio-tracked those animals, I ended up naming all the koalas, and that was when I first started to get in trouble with the scientific community because they wanted to give them radio frequency numbers, and in fact we ended up giving the names of the bulldozer drivers who were going to work on that site. It was a housing estate called Koala Beach. So we had a double whammy, really. We radio tracked the animals and understood how they operated on that landscape. And we also were able to protect the trees, which is fundamentally important, by educating the bulldozers, or the drivers, making them realise this is an individual animal. This is somebody that could be like your cat or your dog, has a personality. And I think that's been one of my greatest achievements in my career, I think.
That's incredibly important. Let's jump back to some more foundation. What was the range and possible population of koalas prior to conquest by Europeans?
Yes, well, that is so important. Australia has only been colonised for a little over 200 years by white men. Aboriginal people have been here between 40 and 60,000 years. So the koala was safe, in my view, when white settlement occurred. And the geographic range is like pretty much almost the same extent as the whole of California. The east coast of Australia is our fertile landscape, and of course as you go further west we just move into deserts and the koala populations decline about 3 or 4 hours drive west. So a bit like from Vancouver to Mexico is the extent. It's 1.5 million square kilometres, which is about 3 million square acres. It's miles, I mean. It's a massive landscape. And that's why it's so hard to save it, because the fragmentation is incredible. And as I drive up the east coast of the west coast of America, I'm reminded as I go through the redwoods and, you know, through John Muir Estate and all those sorts of things, you just realise that's what's happened in our country. We have just lost, we've urbanised everything, put roads in, and that is the death knell for koalas.
So, and what about population? What were estimates pre-contact and what are, and you already said 50,000 probably now.
Yes, well, it's impossible to know how many there were there, and that's why in the introduction, what you said is so important about the skins. We know that at least 8 million skins have gone to market, and there is evidence to suggest that sometimes 3 or 4 times that could have been shot. So I'm prepared to say that there may have been at least 10 million, 12 million koalas at white settlement. And what has been very galling to me, and again, I upset a lot of people when I started talking this, is that the scientific literature said that when white man came, the koala populations were low, and as we killed off the Aboriginal people, which we did, that the koala population rose, and therefore it was okay for a fur industry. Now, I have absolutely opposed that thinking. I don't believe it, and I think that our work about the skins is going to be so important into the future, because if there were 10 million koalas in this landscape and now there's only 50,000, then where did those skins get shot, and could we recover the species back in those landscapes? So there's two things that I think I've still got to achieve in my career. One is that I want to restore the reputation of the Aboriginal people. It just annoys me enormously that we could be, diminishing how they held the landscape, and also recovering the species back to its former range, if that was possible.
And that's a pretty common tactic. In the United States, there are those who argue that the Indians actually wiped out bison, and there are also those who argue that the Indians wiped out the passenger pigeons, and the reason there were so many when the Europeans had been here, you know, that there were flocks that darkened the sky for days at a time, is because the Indian population had decreased when the Europeans conquered. But that's all just nonsense. But okay, so leaving.
That's really interesting. That's really interesting, and validates how I feel. I mean, racism is just so alive and well. And interestingly, our Aboriginal people who I've met, many that I've met over my career, because they were so decimated, a lot of their stories, their dream time, has been lost. And so it has been marvellous for me to sort of unpick this. And so I am very pleased to hear that, because I think the species of the world were in safe hands before white settlement. And I just don't understand why that happened. I just don't, I don't get it. I really don't get it.
Well, yeah, I've written 20 books about it and I don't get it either. It's, you know, it's completely nuts.
Yeah, it is. It is. And it's so frightening, isn't it, that such a small group of people could have done so much damage. I've just been on a 5,000-kilometre journey around the country looking at places where I want to see if I can find places to recover, and it is just gobsmacking. I don't know if you know that word.
Yeah.
But it's just shocking that we did so much damage so fast, and the implications to our landscape are huge because it's such a fragile land.
Well, I want to make one more comment about that, and then let's get back to the koalas. I'm actually writing an essay right now about Western culture's greatest achievement, and I think that their most significant achievement is that they're pretty close to succeeding in murdering the oceans. And that's, I think if you would have asked somebody 500 years ago, do you think they'll be able to actually kill the oceans when they're so full of fish? And they would have said no. You know, it doesn't matter what landscape we look at. It can be wetlands, grasslands. I mean, if somebody would have stood at the end of the Colorado River 500 years ago and said, you know, someday this won't reach the ocean, they would have just laughed at them. And it's the same 10 million koalas. You know, that is a hell of a lot of koalas. And that's in a very negative sense, it's an extraordinary achievement to drop their population down to, what is it, 5%?
Yes, it is an extraordinary achievement, and that's where, and you know, because I love most of the humans that are in my life, not many of the bureaucrats, I'll have to say, but I feel that the endeavour that made this damage happen in the first place has to be turned around, and it has to be turned around now. And although I've been in my post for a long time, I feel that my career is only just beginning, actually, because I think the wisdom of the elders is starting to kick in to me, and I suppose I feel braver than I ever have in my life. And I don't now feel like someone can come up to me and go, look, Deborah, that's just so naive of you. You know, when I was younger, they used to tell me, you know, one day you'll just grow up, Deborah, and realise how the world really operates. Well, I'm going to hang on to that childish notion that you can still fix things. And Mother Nature can be incredibly generous. I live in the bush myself, and I'm looking out on that landscape now, which was like a bowling green when I bought it, and I have restored it. It is koala habitat, and in fact, a koala was seen about 500 metres from here. But restoring landscapes is just the, you know, the most difficult thing to do. And I must confess, I was thrilled at the opening of the Olympics to see the athletes putting seeds in the, you know, into a pot to take to the Amazon. But one of my greatest concerns is that everybody can just drop a tree so fast. A neighbour recently cut down a 300-year-old tree and it went down in an hour. I nearly died. I was so angry. And the technology that we have today is just making those oceans like you described. We can just do so much damage so fast. And on that tour that I told you I just went on, we interviewed people around the country for a documentary, and one young man who was a recreational fisherman said, I'm stopped from doing, you know, one or two fish a day, but the super trawlers can come in off the landscape and just take whatever they like with huge bycatch. And, you know, that young voice, I hope, will be heard, because that's how it should be. If everyone took one or two fish a day, or we all had a chicken and we had an egg every day, we wouldn't have to rape these the oceans like we do. I mean, I can't even bear to think about the oceans. I just can't. In fact, there's very few places I can go to on the planet now where I don't spend my whole time worrying. And I'm concerned about the people who are so urbanized that they don't even think about it.
Yeah, I completely hear you. Let's back up to koalas again. And
yes.
Can you describe, like, I don't know, like, how many babies do they have? How often do they have babies? How quickly can a population, let's pretend that there is some great habitat that has no koalas in it, and a few koalas find it. How quickly can they repopulate, et cetera, et cetera? And also, do they have social groups? Are they mainly solitary? I don't know any of that stuff.
Yes. Well, interestingly enough, there are habitats that are empty, and that is still a conundrum. But I personally think it's a remnant from the shooting times, because I think mothers pass on their information to their babies. You can see the mothers instructing the babies. And when we radio tracked those females, we could see that the young female or the young babies stay in the mother's home range for about 2 years. Now, in the scientific literature again, which I've come to not trust, it says that they're solitary animals. But if you look at the paintings of some of our famous, you know, painters from the 1920s, you actually see koalas sitting together, and indeed in one place in Victoria, I went and got up every hour or so, I went out and had a look what was happening, and our governments believe that those koala populations are overpopulating, that there's too many koalas, which is, you know, nonsense. But I actually think they were a much more social group than people realise, and what we're seeing is just tragic figures. You know, when you see them sitting alone. One place I went to, Derek, there was 400,000 skins that came out of this valley on one ship on one day. And there's now 85 animals in that valley. And those forests are still magnificent. So I believe that we've lost lineage, that the koalas have lost lineage. And this is, I think, a very female way of thinking about things. I offend the male scientists in our country so much with this thinking. Oh, that woman just cares too much. That's one of my their worst criticisms. Well, isn't that great? Because I do care a lot. And I believe that we don't actually know the answer to that. And that's why I wrote my book about personalities. Koalas only have 3 babies in a lifetime, every second year by the looks of things. In the areas where we took the babies away from their mums, like we did to so many terrible things in history, I don't believe the koalas knew how to behave. And so they... And a biologist on the west coast of America actually was explaining to me that sometimes when trees are sick, that animals can eat and be attracted to those trees because of sugars. So I do think in various parts of the country we have koalas that are getting too much sugar and are having a higher birth rate, maybe one a year instead of one every 2 years. But that said, they only live about 8 to 10 years in the wild, and that's not very long to repopulate. So we need a lot more koalas. And no one really has ever translocated any koala population successfully. I can show translocations where developers want to take them out of the landscape. You can get anywhere between 80 and 100% mortality. So, filling those landscapes is going to take a lot of expertise. And I want our organisation to be involved in that.
You said about the mother koalas teaching the youngsters and seeing the bears again, the black bears around here. One of the things the mothers do is they will take a bite of food and then they blow their breath into their baby's face to let the baby know that this is a good food. Mm-hmm. And so how do the koalas, insofar as you know, how do they teach their children?
Exactly the same. You can see the mums. Oh my goodness, that is just so interesting, because I have been to some, you know, bears in America, and yes, I mean, the thing about animals, Derek, that is so beautiful is that of course the mothers teach them things. I mean, where did science get off on that? You know, the scientists treat them like robots.
Speaking of anthropomorphization, by the way, projecting a human creation onto the natural world. I mean, that's using machine language to describe the world is the worst anthropomorphization you could ever have.
Exactly. And so when you watch, you know, I'm going to tell you a story that might sound slightly arrogant, but I was in the high Arctic on a polar bear thing, and I saw this polar bear come along with 2 cubs, and I said, just because, and I don't photograph, I just have my binoculars wherever I go. And so I said, that mother's going to feed those cubs. And this very, very alpha male scientist said to me, oh, Deborah, you'll never see that. You'll never see that. The next thing, she shovels this huge big hole and sits down like a breastfeeding chair and breastfeeds those babies. And anyone who wants to see that photo can see it on my website, on my diary. And all the women in the in the tundra buggy with me went, yep, we've done that. And then the mother went to sleep with the babies in her arms. It was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And then she cut a playpen and put them both in that while she had a rest. Now, I knew that as the koala woman because I love animals. I cannot, you know, every time I'm anywhere in the wild, my binoculars are stuck to my head because you can see how incredible they are and how refined nature is. And these are the things that I talk to the developers about. And they look at you as if you're absolutely crackers. So, yes, the mothers will pick off a eucalyptus leaf, rub it in front of the koalas' noses, and then eat it. And we now know that in different parts of the country, the species are different. So, if you like, it's like meat, vegetables, peaches and ice cream in a dinner mint for koalas. But in various parts of the country, depending on the soil type, it's different meat, different veggies. And so what we found is if you move a koala who's been brought from, say, a fish and chip area and put it in a curry zone, it will not do well. And when I wrote that diary, goodness me, half of the world went, you know, crackers. But it is right. And interestingly enough, I lived in the middle, in Singapore for a long time when I was a young mum. And a girlfriend of mine adopted a baby and she was eating a Webster diet and she wasn't thriving. And all of a sudden we all said, well, maybe she needs rice because she was an Asian. And she started to thrive. So that information helps me in my koala land because I really believe that if you're born in this landscape, you have to learn how to live in that landscape. And that's the information you pass on to your generations. And I know that's the case with koalas. And I'm sure I could write 50 books if I didn't have time, if I had time, about how much disrespect we do to individual animals and to the landscape, you know, in itself. That's why I'm so absolutely obsessed about mapping. If we don't have the trees, we will never recover a species. If you do not protect landscapes, we are going to have to say goodbye to so many species, and I can't bear the thought of that.
Yeah, completely agree. And now my next question is going to be really mechanistic on the back of that, which is, so once again, black bears, one of their functions, or grizzly bears back before they were eradicated in California, one of their functions, quote, in a forest is they carry the salmon through the forest and then they poop to they move nutrients around. And another function of grizzly bears and black bears is they kill trees. They girdle them to eat them. And, of course, dead trees are incredibly important to forests, habitat for lots of creatures. Okay, so what are... You said they're incredibly important. So in a... Once again, I know you and I both sort of hate the utilitarian perspective, but what do koalas do for the forest? I'm like, who eats them? What happens to a forest when they're eradicated? What roles do they play in the forest?
Well, you know, I don't think... I can answer that. I don't think many people can because our forests, see, it's like the panda, the koalas, the eucalyptus leaf is basically not eaten by anyone. So I think in the Aboriginal dream time, they say that the koala was sent up the tree with no water because they don't drink water. They just drink the fluid from the leaves right to the top of the trees and that's where they sit. So it's a really high, low nutrient diet and they have to, and it's toxic. So koala's the only one who eats that. Now, a forest doesn't die because the koalas are missing. So what role did they play? I don't really know. I certainly think they prune the trees. You can see the cockatoos come in my place and every springtime they just start pruning and the whole garden's covered in eucalyptus branches that, and they watch them fall. The cockatoos are hilarious. But there was one koala, and his name was, he actually was 501. That was his radio frequency. This is before I sort of realised that scientists did this. And it was on this site, and we called the head koala Arnie Schwarzenegger because he was so big. And we do think that 501 was his dad and that he'd passed the territory on. And when we planted 3,000 new trees in that landscape, and I used to be able to find 501 in all those young saplings, and he would put his little bottom right in the middle of the tree and break the main stem. And so I can go into that landscape now and say 501 broke that stem, and that's why that koala, that tree has now branched out in a different way. So I could say without him, maybe the tree goes up further in one stalk rather than being broken by his fat bottom. But, you know, honestly, Derek, we don't have time to understand those things. The forests in our country are going down so fast. We clear second only to Amazonia. That these are just lovely notions to consider. I just feel in my lifetime, I just want to make sure the trees are there so the koalas can be brought back. And I believe that they could and would recover if only the trees were still there.
So I want to talk about the trees in just a moment. But one question before there is, so how particular, you said they're particular in terms of living in different places, but do koalas, how can they do in a forest that has been damaged as opposed to, I mean, like the black bears are fairly forgiving. Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah, I am. And look, the thing is, it sometimes astounds me, Derek, that I can see absolutely exhausted habitats and you still see healthy koalas in them. And this is the joy of knowing that nature's is stronger than me, stronger than man, stronger than everyone. You know, that's the thing that makes going to work so exciting. And I've been in some, you know, forests with loggers dropping trees and all of a sudden a koala will come down the tree. But look, the research clearly shows that if you have major disturbances within 2 kilometres of a koala colony, it will go to extinction. It's just a matter of time. Our scientists, you know, get frustrated with me because I'm the communicator, that they won't sort of say to a journalist, the koala has X amount of time. But I can tell you at this time, I'm saying the koala is probably functionally extinct right now. I hate those words. Functionally extinct to your listeners means that it's probably gone beyond the pale. It can't come back in certain landscapes. The fragmentation is the thing that kills it. And it's shocking to me that there are landscapes in some parts of the country that are empty. And I think that's probably because it's not a good habitat for koalas. Koalas need about 10 different species for a healthy diet. If they've got that, it's like blending oils. If you can imagine, it's like meat and veggies, like I said before. If you take the meat away, if you take the veggies away, and you're just eating pumpkin and peaches and ice cream, then you're not going to do and not thrive. So it's events cascade. There are so many problems. And what happens is, we've had these things called offsets appear in the last few years where everyone says, look, we'll knock that down and we'll offset this. That is just an absolute nonsense. It's the emperor's new clothes. But somehow or other, everybody's taking it on board that somehow or other you can have a whole ecosystem move at your will. It's just nonsense. So I don't think koalas do well in a damaged landscape, and why would they? We wouldn't do well in a damaged landscape, and that's going to be our future unless we get it.
So you talk about, you've been very clear about the necessity of saving habitat, and can you talk about efforts, your own efforts and efforts by other people to preserve intact habitat and to talk about stopping deforestation?
Yes, well, my colleagues in the koala world are multifaceted. We have ladies, mostly ladies, but a few fellows, who will take home sick and injured animals and look after them. And so we've all seen those gorgeous TV programs. And there's, when I first got my career, I used to go, well, in fact, my first conference, I thought, how about I get everyone together? I'll bring everyone together. So in 1989, I brought scientists and carers together. And I looked out across this audience, and the scientists were sitting on one side of the room and the carers on another, and they all looked pregnant. And I thought, God, is everyone pregnant? And then I realised that they all had pouches. Everyone had either a koala down their chest or, you know, a possum here or a wombat there. And they're just the most eclectic bunch you'll ever find. So there are since 1989, there are now hospitals springing up all over the country, and that is of great concern to me, because what's happening is that you have the corporatisation of carers, and then what we find is that instead of people being able to see koalas in the wild, in landscapes, now tourists go to see the hospitals, and this offends me beyond belief. And our tourist people go, well, why would that offend you, Deborah? And you go, well, because it would be far better to see them in the wild before they got sick, and even after their return from these hospitals, they will probably die. Everyone sort of pretends that they're going to live happily ever after. So there's koala groups all over the country that do sick and injured. Then if you want to save habitats, you are considered radical. And so in recent times, our governments have passed laws. Anyone who locks on to any sort of equipment, anyone who demonstrates that is in the way of any coal mine, any coal seam gas, any sort of fracking or anything like that, are now under enormous threat of jail terms. And then you have people like us, the Australian Koala Foundation, which began as a scientific organisation. We are the largest funding body of science in the country. And it concerns me greatly that no one listens to that science. By and large, we've mapped those habitats. We could help and create recovery programs for our government. There was a Senate inquiry in 2011. 101 submissions were submitted. 3 Senate hearings in different parts of the country, and by and large it was all ignored. So then you have to ask, well, what forces are we up against? We are up against big business. The koala has absolutely some of the most powerful enemies in the world, and they used to be just the development industry. Now it's coal mining. Now it's even solar-powered power plants, because everyone wants to knock down trees. And in fact, I had a call the other day about a 6,000-hectare site that someone wanted to clear. And I said to them, surely you could find some cleared land somewhere that you could do this project on. Why do you have to knock down virgin bush? And, of course, in their mind, it's cheaper. It's cheaper to buy the bush. So I feel that AKF is unique in its thinking right now. And I think it is because we annoy the politicians so much. And because I'm so vocal and I am very pleased to be on your program, is the bush. We have a fundamental lack of respect for the environment. We think we can have it all. And in our country, we're starting to run out. And that's why I'm committed now to legislation that will stop that destruction. I have never seen destruction like it in my whole 30 years. It's getting worse and worse.
And in this case, when you say you've never seen destruction like it, you're talking primarily about deforestation. Are you saying rates of deforestation are increasing, or are you talking about other forms of destruction?
Well, it's
our, of course, it's a piece.
Yes. Well, our slogan is no tree, no me. We've had that forever and a day. And yesterday I was asked to go and have a look at a habitat that I've never been in before, and the amount of urbanisation in that landscape was just staggering to me, and it was and is still koala habitat. And I thought, this could be so different if those developers had thought things through. What housing estate wouldn't want koalas wandering through it? But what they've got in their head is this, it's actually an American model. I hate to say it, but I do think Australia has just followed the American landscape model of knock it all over, put in an infrastructure, put in a road, cut up everything into quarter acre blocks, and we're all going to live happily ever after and go shopping. That is happening to our country. There's no question. And the rate of that at the moment is enormous.
So, I'm gonna go back to a question that I asked a while ago.
Yes.
Who in the let's pretend that it's either 500 years ago or that somehow things are sane. Who would normally eat koalas?
Well, I don't.
I mean, are there like huge eagles or anything? I'm sorry for such an ignorant question.
No. Of course, look, all continents have the same eco-niches, you know, so there's powerful owls in our country. We have a wedge-tailed eagle here, and in fact I have seen a powerful owl at my home with a wingspan as big as your bald eagle come swooping in and take one of the possums off my possum boxes. So we have all that. Yes, I believe that the koalas would have been taken by both eagles and owls. Snakes too, we have very large boa constrictors that would take them. But no predator really that could wipe them out, in my view. Even the dingo was only a recent introduction to us. They came around about 10,000 years ago. So wild dogs now in our country are a major problem, so are domestic dogs. But 500 years ago, I don't believe the koala had many threats except maybe climate change and drought. And certainly, but, you know, I will just go back to the original introduction. If we shot 10 million, there were a lot in this landscape 200 years ago, and I long for that to come back now.
You know, sorry I keep bringing this back
I don't mind at all.
To the bears I know here, but bears are known for being solitary, but grizzly bears, I've read accounts of, like in the 1840s in California, of, quote, troops, end quote, of grizzly bears. That my point is, just like you were saying about the koalas, once again, I'm in no way suggesting that the word bear means bear, it's just, this is an animal I know.
I understand.
The grizzlies actually were, at that point, fairly social creatures.
Derek, you and I should write a book about this, two koala bear and grizzly bear, because when I've been to Alaska and I've been to, you know, Manitoba, and what I saw with all those bears was so similar to what I see. And I know this is going to sound a bit egocentric here too, but you know how people say David Attenborough's a naturalist. At what point do you become a naturalist? And I remember being in that tundra buggy thinking, I am now a naturalist because I can see behaviours in not only my own species but in other species. And if that's the... I don't know what the definition of naturalist is, but that's what I think it sounds to me, that you have to look at history. Our Aboriginal people will not make any decision on anything unless they look at seven generations back and seven forward. And I had the privilege of working with an Aboriginal elder in the 90s, and I'm not allowed to say his name because he's passed on. Aboriginal people don't like to be referred to after they're gone. But this man said to me, and tutored me on so many things, he said that you would never hurt a koala because they cry like a pickaninny. Pickaninny is actually a Portuguese word. The Portuguese came down past the southern part of our country and did actually mate with the Aboriginal people, and that word came into the Aboriginal word language. And also, he said to me, sister, they're not good eating. Why would we eat them? Because they've got no flesh and they taste like eucalyptus. So, and also the skin doesn't tan well. So if you see photos of Aboriginal women in the southern part of our country, they were wearing possum cloaks, which actually tan well. So I learned little bits and pieces from those elders that are stuck in my soul. And I give and say this in every speech I give anywhere in the world, because I do not believe any of us know anything. And I feel after 30 years I know nothing. And I want another 10 lifetimes to be able to write about it and to have people hear. We have done so much damage, we have to stop. And dare I say, the world is going to be behind me for koalas because they don't eat anyone, Derek. You know, no one's going to come in and raid your camp with a koala. They just sit above your tent and growl. You know, they grunt. I don't know, for your program, maybe you could see if you can get the noise, because they sound like wild pigs, and there's not many people who complain about having that sound keeping them awake. And, yeah, so you go out in the bush in the night time and see all these beautiful animals interacting. It's one of the most glorious things, and why I love going to work every day. And I do hope before we finish this interview that I can tell people they are magnificent. Koalas are magnificent. When I hold one. They do. They'll often cuddle you, especially if they're injured or especially if they are in captivity. But bear in mind that I don't believe that zoos are our future, and that's another discussion we might have one day. We must keep the wild. Well, animals need to be free.
I was gonna mention when you said the thing about hospitals that I wrote a book on zoos several years ago, against zoos, and one of the things I say in there is that zoos teach a very, 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 very terrible lesson, which is the notion that you can remove a wolverine from the wild and still have a wolverine. It teaches you that a wolverine is flesh in a sack of skin, as opposed to the habitat and the smells on the wind. And, you know, the koala is the koala plus the tree plus every other tree plus the boa constrictors who sometimes eat them. This is all, that's what a koala is. A koala is not a cuddly little sack of skin in a baby crib.
Oh, Derek, this is music to my ears, but you know what? We have to have another program on teaching people that zoos are just... I have given papers in the United States at zoo conferences, and I think Dr. William Conway says that in 50 years there'll be no wild places, and I think in my PR now it says, Deborah Tabart says, in 50 years there'll be no zoos. So... you know, that will be exactly how I spend the rest of my life on this planet. And I'm looking out at my bush here, and the foundation was bequeathed a beautiful property about 5 years ago called Quinlan's. And when I am there, some of the most dangerous snakes in Australia are there. It is the highest snake bite area of Australia. Taipans, eastern browns, king browns, blacks and red belly blacks, all beautiful names, Derek, but let me tell you, when you come across one, and so when anyone accuses me of, you know, only caring about the cute and fluffy, I can promise you that at Quinlan's every species is honoured, and I am obsessed when people come. If anyone wants to come to Quinlan's, you have to arrive in boots with long pants and know that you could get bitten by a snake. And, you know, then the tourist authorities go, well, Deborah, you know, it would be so dangerous for tourists to come. And I go, oh, well, no worries. They can come or they can't. It's this bambiology and this nanny state that we've all come to. My grandchildren come to my home and my children know. My children survived living here, and we've had snakes in the house. So you can't save one species and not respect and love another, even if it's dangerous.
So we have about 4 or 5 minutes left, and yeah. One question I want to ask is how can people help your work, and how can they more broadly help koalas? And this is two different questions, one for people in Australia, two for people outside Australia.
Yes. Well, I had the privilege of briefing President Gorbachev's people at one stage, and he says everyone has to be an activist. Everyone has to speak up for the environment. Doesn't matter where you are, even if it's one tree that you can save, then you've done a good job. So all of you, everybody has to do that. We don't take any government money, so we can speak freely, and so a donation to us is fantastic. There's shopping, you can buy all our merchandise and those sorts of things. In America, you can adopt koalas. You know, we have an adoption program of koalas that are in sanctuaries in Australia. And people often come and visit those koalas and fall in love with them. But I really think that the thing you can do for me is that you can change your attitude about something, recycle something. 22 billion paper cups in the United States last year, which is about 7,000 acres of trees that had to be grown to do that. Buy yourself a takeaway coffee cup. I believe in the power of one. Anyone who travels with me and the brown bag lunches I do in Washington, every single young intern has my reputation. If they walk in with a plastic bag or a plastic anything, then I berate them. Because if conservationists think they're above all the rest of us, they shouldn't. And I still get invited, thank goodness, but you know, how we live our lives is imperative. You know, we are so used to packaging, and this packaging damages our planet. And then we keep having to fill it up with rubbish or fill it up with this. Don't, you know, and it takes a lot of courage, Derek. I mean, even I some days, I think, oh my God, do I have to have this fight today? You know, you buy something in a store and they says you have to have a plastic bag because you can't walk out the store with it in your hand. All these things, it takes courage. So I want all of you listening to me, have courage. Change one thing about your life today. It's not about giving money to me. It's about you changing your life.
Well, I loved especially, thank you for that. And I loved especially what you said about protecting even one tree, that you, okay, I'm gonna tell you quickly about a couple of my heroes. And you have become another one, by the way. that one of them is a guy by the name of Dar Jamail, who was just a normal guy in Alaska. And when the United States invaded Iraq, he didn't like the corporate media coverage of the invasion. And so instead of just complaining to his friends about it, which of course he did too, he went to Iraq and did a better job. Or
yeah.
I interviewed this woman, Sherry Tippy, who loves beavers like you love koala. And yeah. She didn't like the fact that when beavers are, when somebody puts in a mall, they just kill all the beavers. And so instead of just complaining about it, she herself, she taught herself how to be a live trapper and now traps them and takes them to, and beavers actually do very well on relocation because there used to be, I think, 100 million beaver in the United States, so there are streams who are dying for beavers.
Yeah.
So that are one example of a creature who can be relocated. And so she just turned herself into the nation's expert on live trapping beavers. And she didn't let her ignorance stop her. And it's just, she got off her butt and did it. So I just, it's just great. So I guess my last question is, how did you start?
Oh, well, you know, I was at a fundraiser for my children's school and there was a table of koala scientists and they said, and I had quite a reputation for raising money, and they said, we need you. And I was divorced with three little kids and I said, you don't have any money to pay me so that I can do this work. And within months I was working with the Australian Koala Foundation. And I have loved every single day, including our interview. And, you know, maybe we can do it another day. But you know what, Derek? How about we write a book on zoos together?
That'd be great. Let's talk about that. Let's set an interview about that. But in the meantime, before the end of this interview, I just want to point out again that you did the same thing as Dar Jamail. You saw a problem, and I mean, the big distinction is not between those who believe it takes militant resistance and those who don't, those who believe we need to shut the whole thing down and those who don't. The big distinction between those who do something and those who do nothing.
Well,
and I love the fact that you're doing something.
Yes, but you know, the great thing too, and I want to say to your listeners, you know, I can be at the office at 9 o'clock at night and sometimes the phone rings and I pick it up and someone says, I want to speak to that Deborah Tabat. And I go, God, why? And they go, I want to give you money. And I go, why? And they go, because I want Australia back. Something about, I am so fiercely Australian and I love it. And my parents raised me that way. So I want you to know there's a lot of people out there who have given me so much support and I can't thank them enough to be able to speak freely as I've been able to do on your very free radio station. And I'm delighted to have been a guest here, Derek. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Deborah Tabat. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.